Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
At Mint Mobile, we like to do the opposite of what Big Wireless does. They charge you a lot, we charge you a little. So naturally, when they announced they'd be raising their prices due to inflation, we decided to deflate our prices due to not hating you. That's right. We're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month slows. Full terms at mintmobile.com.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the History of Byzantium. Episode 173, Dead Ideas Interview, The Varangian God. Today's episode is actually a whole show lifted from another podcast. I was very pleased to be interviewed by Brandon Newberg from the Dead Ideas show on the topic of The Varangian God. He's kindly allowed me to post the episode here on the History of Byzantium feed, and I think this works out well because it allows me to talk about the Varangians, giving you all the info you're looking for, but in a different setting. It was nice to have a chat and some back and forth on the topic, and Brandon brings a different perspective to it, which I think was very valuable. We talk about the role of the guard in both the palace and the field armies, as well as contrasting them with court eunuchs, both now dead ideas, but ones which solved a lot of problems in Byzantium. And that's the aim of the Dead Ideas podcast, to talk about historical solutions to problems that we no longer use. Brandon shares the mic with a team of contributors who have a fun and informative chat about ideas which didn't stand the test of time. And they range across history from Stonehenges and ancient languages via Vikings and serfdom to Titoism and Halloween. Check them out at deadideas.net or wherever you get your podcasts. In particular, you should listen to the episodes in the run-up to this one. This is actually a part of a series about eunuchs entitled Cutting Your Junk Off to Get Ahead. They have a good discussion about the role of eunuchs in Byzantium, as well as looking at the career of our old friend Narses, Justinian's trusted official. Now, here's the interview.
Today's Dead Idea? Well, this is the conclusion of our series on Byzantine court eunuchs, and we have got something very special for you today, folks. The host of the History of Byzantium podcast, Robin Pearson, is here to talk with us today about the Varangian Guard, the Byzantine Emperor's elite bodyguards composed entirely of Vikings, or at first at least, we'll get into that. And we're going to be exploring the connections between why both these Vikings and eunuchs were entrusted with such important positions in Byzantium. That's what we're talking about today on Dead Ideas. Hey, thanks for listening, everybody. The music we just heard was composed by Rachel Westhoff, my lovely wife. This morning, she tossed back her long Viking braids, hefted her mighty Dane axe over her shoulder, and said, "Well, I'm off to Miklagard to make my fortune. I'll send you a postcard." Miklagard is what the Vikings called Byzantium, or Constantinople, and many just like her sought wealth and renown in the Queen of Cities, leading to the bizarre scene of beardless Byzantine court eunuchs standing next to thick-bearded, axe-wielding Vikings. It's a cultural juxtaposition so weird it seems like it could only happen in comic books, but it was the real thing, and surprisingly, eunuchs and Vikings were employed for much the same reasons. To help us sort this out, we have a very special guest today, the host of the podcast History of Byzantium, which I used as part of my research for this series, by the way. Very glad to have on the show Robin Pearson. Thanks for being on the show, Robin.
Hey, it's great to be here.
Yeah, thank you. I'm really excited about this. Let's get to it.
Okay.
Yeah, so Vikings in Byzantium, really?
That's right.
Yeah, it seems like a pastiche of culture. So weird. It's just, what is up with that? What was up with these Varangians? So the first thing I want to ask you is, who were the Varangians? And how did they end up in Byzantium? This is just weird. What do you got?
Well, I should just say that for research, I listened to some of your back catalogue, and I was particularly interested in your critique of history podcasters. So the first thing straight off is I wanted to call them Varangians, and that's not for any I know better reason. That's purely how I read it off the page. And then I thought, if I bring this up, you're going to be furious that we're talking about pronunciation immediately. But so I think we should both stick with how we're doing it to make the point that it doesn't matter. So...
That's
my opening salvo.
Perfect. All right. So I'll go with Varangians. You go with Varangians, and we can mutually alienate both sides of our audience.
Exactly. There you go.
Nice.
Mutually assured destruction. So, Well, I also know you've covered the Vikings in great detail on Dead Ideas. So it's good to know your audience is familiar. Varangian is the Eastern term for Viking. And these, Scandinavian warrior merchants were looking for the most lucrative markets. And so that across, as they travel the waterways of Eastern Europe, that takes them towards Baghdad and Constantinople. And so the branch who head towards Constantinople make their way down the Dnieper River. And... Mm-hmm. When they get to Constantinople, they think, right, this is the place to make serious money. They're going to be bringing their fur and their amber and their slaves, to name, some of the most lucrative items, and making...
And they'll soon be starring in like a Beverly Hillbillies kind of remake.
Yes, exactly. There's gold in that city.
Exactly.
So they're trekking back with bags of gold coins, and it's obviously a huge distance to get back to the Baltic Sea. So they start creating trading towns along the Dnieper, places like Smolensk and Polotsk and Kiev, which becomes kind of the capital of the state that forms in that area. And the warrior qualities are noted by the Byzantines when these men arrive. And so, inquiries are made, and it's said, well, if you guys fancy serving in the Byzantine army, we could certainly use your skills. And obviously they see that the pay is good. And so people start staying behind and serving on particular campaigns for the Byzantines. And
and this is not really the guard yet. This is just all build up, right?
Exactly. So initially, I think what attracted the Byzantines was the skills that Varangians had on water, that they were essentially like marines. Their lifestyle was, rowing incredibly fast up to a place to take it by surprise, jumping ashore, grabbing things. And so the Byzantine navy started to pick them up to serve on campaigns in and around the Aegean, and particularly attempting to retake Crete from the Arabs, which had caused a huge amount of problems. And so initially during the 9th century, these Varangians were picked up as mercenary troops, and that's how the Byzantines started to think about employing them on a longer term basis.
Yeah, that's cool. I like that you pointed out specifically their seafaring skills, because I think our stereotype of a Viking is some big, hulking, huge, barbarian warrior, and with the main virtue of him just being able to, like, squash you in one blow. But the Vikings weren't really any better fighters than anybody else at the time, but they were more like hit-and-run kind of guerrilla sea pirates, and that was their real specialty, I feel like.
Absolutely. And, yeah, I think, later on that their physical size and appearance definitely played a part, but I think the Romans, the Byzantines knew that discipline was generally more important in a set piece battle than ferocity, but that people who were good on the sea were much rarer. It's interesting. You started to set up the unusual appearance of the Byzantine court, and I suppose that's partly, you know, where the Byzantines have a weakness. They look to someone else to provide a strength, and they never in Roman history was the navy given a kind of prominence where men would think that's where I want to make my fame and fortune. And so, despite having a lot of merchant sailors, the navy was never a powerful or prestigious place. So I think definitely the seafaring skills was what attracted them to the Varangians early on.
That's a weird aspect of the Roman Empire. I don't disagree at all. It's just really strange considering that they are an entirely like sea-based empire because they're all around the Mediterranean, right?
So. Absolutely. I mean, the Mediterranean is what makes the Roman Empire possible. But they do. Yeah. They kind of think, well, if we can just land our troops on the other side, then we can carry on having land battles and that'll avoid us having right. to learn these new skills. So yeah, they managed to go around and around it.
Excellent. So that's how the Varangians ended up in Byzantium. So how did the guard get started then?
So I imagine lots of your listeners have heard of Basil II, Basil the Bulgar Slayer. He's one of the more famous Byzantine emperors, and he had a reputation as a conquering leader. But he didn't start out that way. He grew up under the thumb of some very famous generals, and this is in the late 10th century. And those generals kind of ruled on his behalf while he was a child. And by the time he turned 18, he was ready to rule on his own. But the families of those famous generals said, you know, no, we want to continue running things for you. And so this led to a very, very damaging series of civil wars. And Basil just found he couldn't trust his best troops because they'd been serving with these generals for years. And so he needed experienced soldiers from somewhere else who he could rely on. And so he turned to Kiev. And so Kiev by now had become a state on its own, no longer just a trading post. And so Basil contacted their ruler, Vladimir, and he wanted to get troops from him. And so he made quite a momentous decision, which was to offer his sister's hand in marriage. And this had never been done before, a sort of true-born Roman princess marrying a barbarian, as the Byzantines would have seen it. And so Vladimir agreed to convert to Christianity to make it more respectable. And he got a very good sort of PR deal from this. And in exchange, he forwarded 6,000 Varangian troops. So kind of a mixture of actual Vikings from the north and locals, which we'll kind of talk about in a bit, I suspect. And they arrived and they were very effective. They kind of immediately defeated one section of a rebel army and then helped Basil defeat the next section. And he was so pleased with their work that he incorporated them kind of as a unit within the armies, but then took the cream of them and made them into his personal bodyguard. And as you hinted at in your introduction, the key for him was that they have no loyalty to anyone else. They don't know the rest of the army, so they only know me and I'm paying them well. And so that's how they became the imperial bodyguard, and it stuck. You know, future emperors did not make a change for the next 200 years, and so the Varangians became a fixture at court.
Right. So, yes. Okay. Excellent. So to drill down into that, basically, you've already got these Rus Vikings, mostly, that are in the army, making themselves known, kind of distinguishing themselves as like seafaring fighters, etc. Right. And then Basil II comes along. He's a super suspicious type. His family has a long history of like assassinations and political intrigues and backstabbing and stuff. So he has very good reason to be paranoid about somebody taking him down. And as you mentioned, like the other generals who are in charge of his armies, which he, you know, as emperor, should ostensibly be the one in charge of, but he's afraid of his own army, right? So who's he going to trust? The Vikings. an outsider. Yeah, so exactly. That makes sense. So basically, the big reason to bring in a foreign unit to be a bodyguard is because you can't trust your own friends.
Yeah.
You can't trust your own people.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
And this was something that other empires did. The Islamic Caliphate, at about the same time, started hiring Turkish steppe nomads to come down and serve as, you know, the same thing, kind of the bulk of the army and bodyguards. You know, and in both cases, the idea is nobody's going to support these foreigners to be the new rulers. Nobody's going to say, oh, that Varangian captain, he's a handsome, well-spoken guy. Let's make him emperor. Mm-hmm. Because ultimately, sure, you know, racism is going to trump that. He's not from here. He doesn't know our ways. He may not even be a Christian. So there's no way he's going to be emperor. And as you say, he has no stake in society, which is such an important thing. He has no wife and family in the provinces saying, hey, you know, our local lord would make a great emperor. How about we agitate in that direction? And I think one of the things about the guard that works out very well for Byzantium is that you can recruit new guards. You can say, you know, this guy's been around for 10 years. I don't like the way he's getting friendly with people. Let's pat him on the back, hand him a bag of gold and say, you're out of here, and recruit a young guy who's just turned up on the docks. Because then we can kind of refresh their outsiderness without, you know, losing the strength and the skill they bring.
Interesting. Okay, yeah, I never really quite drilled down into that nuance. That makes a lot of sense. So we're already kind of getting into the reason for employing Varangians that is also shared with eunuchs. So basically what it sounds like is the Varangians were valued and sought after because they were trustworthy precisely because they were foreigners and they had no local stake, no local support. They depended entirely on the emperor for their livelihood, and if it wasn't for the emperor, they would be adrift, right? And so they were much more likely to stay loyal that way. And interestingly, as far as my research turned up for eunuchs, that's pretty much the same reason why eunuchs got started, at least in the beginning, because they were mostly foreigners. In the late Roman Empire, they were entirely foreign-born, and they were despised in late Roman culture. So they had no local ties either, really, because they were kind of outcasts within the society. And so, therefore, if the emperor was employing them, much like the Varangian guard, then they were likely to be loyal to the emperor over anybody else, because again, in the very same way, it sounds like, as the same way as for the Varangians, the emperor is paying them well, giving them the high status they wouldn't otherwise have. And if they ever said, see you later to the emperor, they'd be screwed. So does that kind of fit with what you found for your research about the Varangians, or how do you see that interplay there, the comparison?
Yeah, I agree with you. There are definite similarities. As you say, the eunuchs could be both foreign or local, but
Later on they could be. Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. So yeah, I mean, there was always likely to be a lot of foreign eunuchs around because castrating young boys was technically illegal, even though it went on all the time. And obviously, it wasn't encouraged in lots of circles. whereas you could buy foreign slaves at market, and well, that's not my fault that someone did that. And yeah, I think. But what you said about being despised, I think, is important there. That again, where sort of natural racism towards these strange Northmen and their strange ways. There's a revulsion that goes along with eunuchs, which I think, you know, again, the comes from sort of not knowing what they're up to in the palace. But also, I think, you know, probably just basic gender fear of, you know, you don't know what they are, you don't know what they want. And that fear, I think, is makes both Varangians and eunuchs unattractive to the general population. And that's key for emperors, that they're not, you know, they're not likely to gain a following. They're not likely to be seen as a natural ally for another constituency in the state. Mm-hmm. I think, as we're sort of hinting at, there's more variety in eunuchs, that because a eunuch could be a Roman, this mm-hmm. as you're sort of hinting later on, this becomes more common, that a Roman family will have five sons, and in thinking, well, we'll have to divide our estate between five, that's a waste of time, let's just castrate the younger ones and send them to work in the palace, which obviously sounds horrific to us, but did often lead yep. to, you know, you have a son who's now in the palace, and regardless of mm-hmm. how high he rises, that's still a very valuable connection. And so, yeah, eunuchs sort of have more variety. The Varangians are very unlikely to ever gain a stake in society. If a Varangian stays long enough and he decides, I'm going to become a Roman, I'm going to convert, I'm going to buy a farm, well, likely he's going to be shipped out at that point, and he may just want to leave anyway to live on his farm. So he's not going to become a political problem. Whereas a eunuch mm-hmm, mm-hmm. could have relatives and friends who they can agitate for. So, yeah, and I think, again, with the variety, eunuchs were needed in a way that Varangians weren't. You know, there's always a need for loyal bodyguards, but it doesn't have to be a Varangian. Whereas men who are going to hang around your wife and children, you're always going to need eunuchs. That was the Byzantine logic. Mm-hmm. So there's mm-hmm. definitely strong parallels between the need for both. But the Varangians' timing was quite specific to this era. But I'll say one thing in the Varangians' favor in this, because we're sort of, you know, eunuchs
okay.
were around longer. Obviously, eunuchs also served in other cultures and courts. But mm-hmm. the Varangians were not just valued because they were foreign mercenaries. It was also because they had a code of honor amongst themselves that made them a cohesive unit.
Yes, thank you for saying that. Go on.
So, I mean, the etymology of Varangian is quite complicated, and there's sort of academic debate about it. But one common claim is that it meant something like companion. So mm-hmm. that a unit of Varangians meant, you know, we're off on a trade mission. And obviously where we can't trade, we're going to raid. So we're going to need to really trust each other. We're going to be gone from home for months, years at a time. And we need to all agree, A, that we stick together, and B, that we divide up the loot fairly. Because, you know, mm-hmm. you might say, well, look, I play a valuable role, but if Olaf here decides to beat me up, there's nothing I can do about it. So you need to have a mm-hmm. strong agreement and a code of honor that we all obey. And that was seen as a really valuable cohesive part of the Varangian Guard. And one Byzantine historian kind of put it in a way that's quite helpful. And the quote is, they regard loyalty to the emperors and the protection of their persons as a family tradition, a kind of sacred trust and inheritance handed down from generation to generation. And so I think it's that culture that made them different to, say, you know, a bunch of say Turkish warriors that you get in who've just arrived and are told, will you be the emperor's bodyguard? Well, maybe they'll be more susceptible to a bribe here or there. Whereas the Varangians came with this code of honor saying, we stick together through thick and thin, and you are now our patron. We're making an oath of loyalty to you that we take seriously. And so that culture mm-hmm. Made them a bit different from other foreign mercenaries, and indeed from some eunuchs who indeed might have other interests they might turn to if politics worked against them.
Yes, absolutely. I think that's a really key observation to make, and an excellent contrast in addition to our comparison with eunuchs here. And to drill down even more deeply into that Viking culture predisposition to loyalty, I think there's an interesting distinction too, just between the kind of societies that they're coming from, Byzantine versus Viking. Byzantines, obviously, they have large cities. You know, you've got like Constantinople, you know, very like kind of like high urbanization scale of culture. The Vikings were scaling up at the time, but they were nowhere near that same level of like population and anonymity that you would have rampant in an urbanized culture, which anonymity being something that tends to break down bonds of loyalty and trust that you would otherwise maybe find in like a small town kind of ethos, right? And Vikings, although some of them might come from the bigger towns and cities in Scandinavia, a lot of them were just farmers, you know, and they'd be coming from that kind of like, well, in the case of the stateside here, just kind of like a Midwest kind of like, I'm from a corn growing town in Iowa kind of a background. I don't know what the perfect analogy would be for over the UK for you, but I don't know, like the Midlands or something. I'm not sure. In any case, there's a very different kind of value set that naturally is conduced to by when you're everybody around you has multiple relationships to you, right? Like you're not just my barber, you're also my mayor and also the person who supplies my wagon wheels. And so I'm not going to screw you over in one relationship because that'll mess up all my other relationships with you. Whereas in a large scale society like the Byzantines had, at least in the big cities, you could do that. You had that anonymity. And so you could be much more kind of backstabbing. And that's kind of a lot more like our cultures today, where we have large cities and stuff. And it's actually a lot like the internet and social media. You have total anonymity oftentimes. And so you can be very vitriolic. So the Vikings were coming from the opposite of that. And so they had just in the fiber of their cultural being, this kind of natural tendency to value each other's word and to stand by their word and therefore be loyal. Does that kind of fit with what you read as well?
Yeah, that's a very interesting perspective. And I think that all adds to the sense of recruit fresh Varangians all the time, mm-hmm. keep them coming in and keep them apart so that localness and the sense that they really only know each other and therefore have, you know, don't know anyone else who could pay them, become stronger. And yeah, I think that's an excellent point. And we get a sense that they created a kind of barracks culture where, you know, new arrivals would come and see, oh, look at all the great names that served here. Like this is a little home away from home. They didn't arrive and go straight into a Roman style homestead. And so, yeah, and so you had a kind of feedback with people who'd made their fortune and gone home saying to, you know, younger relatives or whatever, oh, you should definitely go. And so, yeah, maintain that northern culture within this self-contained unit. Yeah, I think that's very interesting. And I think that's something that local-born eunuchs obviously did not have, that they'd grown up in Roman society, and they obviously that's a great advantage in administering and knowing how things work. But it exactly what you're saying, it gives you great opportunities for forming connections outside of the emperor's knowledge.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and like you say, as the late Roman Empire transitioned into what what historians call the Byzantine Empire, the eunuchs did, of course, rise higher and higher in terms of social status. And that's when you started getting, you know, actual Byzantine families being like, castrating one of our sons sounds like a pretty good idea.
Yeah.
Pretty good life for them. And then at that point, the whole idea that you can trust eunuchs because they have no other person to depend on but you starts to break down. And for the Varangians, I feel like that kind of got going as well the longer they stayed in Byzantium. So it's really interesting the part that you mentioned about how you would keep recruiting fresh. That's something that I didn't realize myself. So yeah, that is a very interesting way to deal with the same problem from a different perspective.
Yeah, exactly. And, you know, I think there's always going to be a certain level of adaption. The sources aren't clear how Christian the god was, because certainly early on there's a lot of atrocities attributed to the Varangians, and you get the sense that the emperors were quite glad to have non-Christian troops, you know, people who weren't worried about their soul necessarily, and they weren't worried about you know, people they knew having to be killed or mutilated or something. And
or even or even just worrying about what the Christian next to them thinks about how much of a Christian they are, which might be even more relevant. They developed a reputation for some very brutal things, and in fact, were specifically employed to take care of a lot of the dirty work. So maybe this is a good point that we can start talking about the roles that the Varangians played in the Byzantine Empire.
Absolutely. Yeah, and that, as we're kind of hinting at, they were kind of, the guard at the capital had a lot of sort of police or even secret police work, though I don't suppose there was much secret about what they were up to. But
yeah, apart from the secret part, they do kind of feel like KGB to me.
Yeah, exactly. I think that's right. I think there was a lot of security force work going on, you know, not just crowd control, but also kind of informal intimidation or torture when there was serious suspicion of treachery going on. Mm-hmm. That's kind of behind the scenes. The things we hear about in the sources are when, you know, so-and-so has to be blinded. It's the Varangians who are sent in to do it. Mm-hmm. But they sort of played a similar role on campaign, because a lot of attention is focused on the guard, which obviously is only a few hundred men who kind of live in and around the palace. But there was usually a Varangian unit, you know, of several thousand who would go on campaign. And there again, we hear of, you know, people have taken refuge in a church and the Varangians burn it down, which again, you struggle to imagine would be an order that every soldier in that army would want to carry out. And a certain amount of marking their territory as the emperor's chosen troops. Which again, kind of helps balance, you know, native elements of the army who might think, might have ideas about replacing the emperor with their general. You're going to have to go through these thousands of loyal soldiers. One thing we could do in terms of talking about Varangians on campaign is to talk about Harald Hardrada, who's one of the few Varangians we know quite a lot about, and he's probably the most famous. But his career kind of tells us the variety of things that a Varangian soldier might be asked to do. So I imagine most of your audience, sort of that name rings a bell. He was obviously quite famous for his part in the 1066 battles in England that led to eventually to the Norman conquest. But Harald was one of the sons of the King of Norway, and his father was killed in battle when he was 15. And so he fled, and by about 20, I guess, he was in Constantinople, and, you know, he was told, oh, there's good money to make there. So he joins the guard, and he ends up fighting as a marine, kind of trying to clear the Aegean of Arab pirates who were still operating there when he first arrived. Or, you know, the Byzantines thought of them as piratical campaigns. Mm-hmm. Then he was sent to fight in Sicily, which again involved a certain amount of naval warfare, but he also fought on land both there and in southern Italy. And this is where you get kind of stories about him that probably aren't true, but are great stories. I think one of the famous ones, which I think may be attributed to other people, but is that, you know, these Italian towns are very hard to take because they're up in the hills. And so it's quite hard to approach them. And that Harald saw that they had a lot of thatched roofs where birds were nesting. Mm-hmm. And that he caught one of these birds and attached a taper to it and set fire to it so that the bird flew, you know, for as fast as it could back to its nest and set fire to the roofs of these houses. So whether that's true or not, it's he was certainly involved in these kind of guerrilla campaigns to get inside a town and get, you know, a Byzantine governor back installed.
Yeah, a lot of the stories about him are just like you would expect it in a Dungeons and Dragons campaign more than like an actual military history.
Absolutely. And then he was back in the Balkans putting down a Bulgarian revolt, and he'd served with distinction on a number of campaigns, and so he kind of he won great favor from the emperor at the time, Michael IV. And then when Michael V took over, Harald was imprisoned on suspicion of treachery, which is an interesting one, because obviously we think of the Varangians as being above suspicion. But clearly, you know, life happens. And fortunately for Harald, Michael V was eventually killed by the mob, or rather chased down by the mob and blinded. And again, it's claimed that Harold was the one who did the blinding, that he was released from prison. Again, he's everywhere in his own biography. Mm-hmm. But that certainly gives you an idea that even a Varangian could kind of become a favorite and then become persona non grata with the next ruler. You know, it's always dangerous to be at the top and to be one of the leaders of the guard. But there you go. So he kind of served all over the place, on land and sea, and you know, his fortunes went up and down with the emperor he was serving. So you could be quite a varied career as a Varangian soldier.
Yeah, absolutely. And also, I like the hint at the trust that was placed in the Varangians didn't always work out so well, right?
Yeah.
Because one of the other bits about how loyalty works for the Viking ethos, and there was one story where it's like there was somebody who snuck into the palace or something to assassinate the emperor. The Varangians rushed to the scene, but they got there just too late, just after the assassination was completed. And so instead of killing the assassin or like fighting to the death to attempt to do so, which they would have done had the assassination not been completed yet, instead they knelt and were like, hey, you're our new boss. We're loyal to you now. Still super loyal, but it's just like it's to the boss, not to the person, kind of, you know.
Yeah.
So
There are various stories like that where there is some debate amongst the guard. Do we defend to the death this loser, basically this person who is clearly on the losing side of this civil conflict, or do we switch allegiance to the next guy? So there's definitely, you know, as much as you are loyal and you stick to your oaths, you are not suicidal. But generally, I can't think that there are many accounts of Varangians being directly involved in a conspiracy,
right,
where that had been a consistent feature of earlier Roman history, that captains of the Praetorian Guard were involved in, you know, changing emperors. So I think generally they had a good record of avoiding being implicated in that kind of thing. And I suspect if they had been, then the tradition would have died out much quicker. But yeah, obviously, if your master is already dead, then you need to think about whether you want to be hacked down to the last man or whether you want to reassess your priorities.
Yeah, because they were human after all, just like the rest of us,
absolutely,
right?
Absolutely.
So speaking of the tradition dying out, this seems like a good transition point to talk about how the Varangian Guard as a tradition came to its end. And we were just talking about Harald Hardrada and how he played a role in the battles leading up to the Norman conquest, which the Norman conquest surprisingly also had a huge impact on the Varangians way down in Constantinople. So can you tell us a little bit about how the Varangian Guard changed over time and eventually kind of dwindled away?
Yeah, so with the Norman takeover of England, there were many Anglo-Saxon warriors who had lost their lands and their purpose. And so many of them came to Constantinople because they knew that here was a paymaster looking for men of their type. And so, during the late 11th and 12th century, the guard became quite dominated by Anglo-Saxon and Danish warriors.
And the connection you mentioned with Anglo-Saxon and Danish Viking warriors, that's significant, right? Because at that time, they had the Dane law in England, right? So those Danish warriors were actually coming from England as well. Is that right?
Yeah, I think so. And again, they shared both the fighting style and the kind of ethos, the kind of what you're talking about, non-urban, loyal to your kind spirit that was a key part of the Varangian ethos. So yeah, they came to dominate after 1066 and ended up fighting the Normans again in various other theaters. But yeah, I mean, so the culture of the guard changed. We kind of talked earlier that various reports say, oh, this church was dedicated to northern saints, or this church was handed over for Varangian use. So they may have become more Christian. It's hard to tell how deep that went. But I think I think the real change came in the fortunes of the Byzantines. I think the guard would have gone on being employed in some form, but the Fourth Crusade in 1204 sacked Constantinople, and the Byzantines never really recovered, and they certainly never recovered a kind of central treasury from which a large mercenary contingent could be paid. So we do hear of people who are described as Varangians serving all the way through from 1204 to about 1400. And so small groups may have been continued to be employed by the various successor kingdoms, and then when the Byzantines took back Constantinople. But the tradition, the lineage had been broken, and so had the treasury, really, that could afford to pay them. Because they were paid very well. They sound a bit like bankers at times. They're highly paid and given bonuses whenever something happens. And so I think once that dried up, you've lost the great demographic boom that led to the Viking era. You've lost the money to pay them. It dwindled away.
Mm. Well, this has been a really interesting, awesome conversation. Thank you so much, Robin. This is really cool and fills out so much of the nuance of what that was like, having these like pseudo KGB bearded Vikings running around doing the dirty work. This the sense of why they were there.
Pleasure to be here, and I think this is it's an excellent dead idea topic, because it makes you look at today, particularly in the West, where we, to a large extent, rely on a peaceful meritocracy to fill the same roles. And so you go back into the past and you say, when you could not have that, what did you do instead? And yeah, these are two interesting solutions to that problem.
Yeah, it makes you think about, exactly. If we lost our capital, like what would the successor government look like after that?
Yes.
Who would you trust, right?
Absolutely. Yeah.
Folks, that's it for our episode on the Varangian Guard, and it is it for our series on Byzantine court eunuchs, cutting off your junk to get ahead. What's up next? Well, we are going to have a one-off episode on a dead scientific theory coming up. Specifically, we're going to be talking about the idea of the canals of Mars. That is the idea that the planet Mars is crisscrossed with visible lines so long and straight they can only be artificial constructions, i.e. evidence of a vast and technologically superior extraterrestrial civilization. That was a thing, and that is what we're going to be talking about next. And then after that, we are going to have our final series for the show. I'm still keeping it a secret at this point, but as revealed earlier, it will be about the ancient Roman world and the most surprising and unexpected part of the ancient Roman world at that. That's your teaser, and we'll leave it there. All right, folks, I'll see you next time. I'm BT Newberg, and this is Dead Ideas.
Hey everyone, Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford tough, built Ford proud.